I'm Brian Hyatt. This is Rolling Stone Music Now. Today we're bringing you an interview I did with Noel Gallagher, who has a really strong new album out called Council Skies. Noel was, as always, in fine form and maybe even more reflective than usual, talking about his new album, growing up as an artist, why he's convinced that his brother Liam Gallagher is not really serious about wanting to reform Oasis, and a lot more. Here's that conversation. I see you're already playing some of the new stuff. How's that going down in the first two shows?
Oh, terrible. I'm starting off with five new ones, which people should have bought the fucking album then, shouldn't they? So they're going to stand there with their mouths open thinking, what the fuck is this? I should advise them to go to their preferred streaming service.
I'm really enjoying this album, unlike your crowds. Mojo said it's your best post-Oasis work, and I might be inclined to agree. Do you agree, though?
I'd say song for song, yeah. I mean, there are great songs on the previous three albums. And the first one, yeah. They've all got their merits. But this one, song for song, is the best, I think, anyway.
A song called Easy Now. So you are the best. This album that everyone has been focusing on. There's a bunch of great ones, but everyone keeps fixating on that one. People say it has an Oasis vibe. I also hear Pink Floyd in there. Real epic song. But something you said while talking about this song struck me, and it struck me that you might be falling into the same sort of mental trap that maybe Paul McCartney fell into after the Beatles, which is that after Oasis, when you write something that feels like Oasis, you shy away from it. And I know that Paul said the same thing for years. If something sounded like the Beatles, he'd jump away from it. Do you think that's, you're doing yourself a disservice by shying away from that?
Not really, because I've only persevered with this song because it was so good. All the rest of them that I've shied away from have not been. As soon as I hit a chorus, I just go, nah, there's no point in me putting it out. And then a load of people going, it sounds like a shit Oasis. I know it does. However, when I was writing this song and I got to the chorus, I was like, but fucking hell, actually, this one's pretty good. Yeah, but it's not, during the period of writing this album, I wrote a lot of material, and there is a lot of material coming down the line that's very heavily guitar-based. So I guess people will say it's Oasis-y, but we're not there with it yet. But I only shy away from it if the songs don't stand up. Do you know what I mean? In this case of McCartney, if he's writing a song and it starts to sound like We Can Work It Out, are you going to fucking beat that anyway? How are you going to beat that? So you've done it. He's done it. So I understand where he's coming from when that is the case. And when you can't really afford to think about what other people might think of it. Well, you know what? If you're writing it, and then you think, oh, but other people might like it, so I'll persevere with it. That's not what is, I'm afraid.
I guess the counter-argument would be something like Band on the Run could be a Beatles album, and it's one of people's favorite Paul albums.
Paul McCartney is the sound of the Beatles. So if he's writing a song, it's going to have echoes of that. But I guess as a songwriter, it would be an instinctive thing. Instinct drew me to finish off Easy Now, and I was right. I seen it to the end, and it was right. And what I heard in my head when I was writing it, I got out of the speakers and I was proved right. In the past, instinct has led me to stop writing those kind of songs. You'll know if I was right or wrong. I'm in charge of this kind of thing, not everyone else.
This was an album that you wrote in lockdown during the pandemic. And you said the other thing that happened in the pandemic, you have had a marriage split up. There's a history of great divorce albums. Is this in some way one of those?
One or two songs. I wouldn't say the entire album is like that, but I wouldn't go as far as to describe it or pigeonhole it as that, but certainly Dead to the World. I don't know where I've been, and if you say so, I'll think of a number. Directly about that, yeah.
The song Council Skies, and I know the whole album isn't about growing up in Council Flats, but that song is. How do you look back at that now, especially as someone who became rich?
It gave me a really strong work ethic, and it gave me the sense that if I want anything doing, or if I want anything out of life, I should go and get it for myself, not rely on other people. But it makes you who you are. I don't really take what I do for granted. Do you know what I mean? I could, each time I get to the end of a cycle, I'm like, will I ever write another song? And I just keep going and for the fear of losing it. But I just think it was meant to be. I just think that's the story of my life. I wouldn't go as far as to say that I think that life from the day you were born is preordained. But I do believe that there's a path that you're, the way that you are as a person will set you upon a path, and then you're presented with some life-changing choices along the way, and you either make the right ones or the wrong ones. But I just think it was all, I think it was meant to be. I can't think anything other than that, because I've never really tried to manipulate where I was going. I write songs, and I, wherever they take me is wherever I am.
There are people for whom a dramatic change in circumstance, like the one that you had when you were young, becoming rich and famous when that was so far from your upbringing, for some people, it's almost like a trauma. It's so shock. It's such a shock to the system to find yourself in a different place. I don't get the sense that maybe it was like that for you. It feels like an unadorned triumph for you, but I could be wrong.
Yeah. No, I agree. The extreme version of the downside of fame would be Amy Winehouse.
Yeah.
Who was a lovely, happy-go-lucky, great songwriter. Fuck, you know, she was just great and cheeky and beautiful. And then she got famous. It killed her. I always took great comfort in knowing that I always had the work, and the work is what anchored me. I took more drugs than anybody else and all that kind of thing. And I always had the work ethic, and I always had the work to lean back on. I wasn't like a fucking bass player sitting around waiting for shit to happen and then accidentally getting involved in fucking heroin while he was waiting for that to happen. So I always had work to do, and I just tried to combine living like a rock star with being a songwriter. And for the most part, I did all right.
The song Pretty Boy, awesome song. Beneath the starry sky of a distant. You joked about fans complaining that it starts with a drum machine. The guys from U2 once told me, half jokingly or not jokingly at all, complaining about that their fans are not as groovy as sometimes they would want them to be. That sometimes when they do, and they've gone way farther into dance oriented stuff than you have, but you've really played around with that in recent years.
I was saying to Adam recently, I was saying, it's a good job there was no such thing as social media when you were making that album, because you would have fucking found out exactly what your fans thought of it.
You mean pop?
No, Acton Baby.
Acton Baby.
Because I guess U2 fans are not unlike Oasis fans. They would like to rewrite the Joshua Tree forevermore. And I would assume Oasis fans would like me to rewrite Definitely Maybe forevermore. But you're not really stretching yourself as an artist then, but people have a set opinion of what you are and what you should do. And if you don't live up to that, then they get frustrated. That's what being an artist is, you know what I mean? You can't please everybody. So you might as well just please yourself and hope that your taste is somewhat connecting with other people.
At the same time, it's not exactly Radiohead, is it?
No, it's not like I'm fucking making French prog music, is it? So it's just a drum machine. That's all it is. It's a drum machine and a weird video. Don't worry about it. Don't cry.
Have you done stuff in private that is much weirder and more experimental than we've ever heard?
I wouldn't say I've written anything. I've been involved with producers who have turned it into that, yeah. When I worked with the Amorphous Androgynous, when I was going to, that album that got scrapped, that was too fucking weird. There was fucking sitars on everything and it didn't move me in any way whatsoever, so I scrapped it. I'm actually quite limited as to what I do, because I'm not a virtuoso musician, so I do what I do and that's it. And then if I have a sound in my head, then I'll go for it. But no, I don't really go out of my way to write weird shit. I'd be forcing it. Everything has to come naturally, and it does.
It does feel like there are places on this album where I noticed that you were branching out chord-wise. Do you like to indulge in fancy chords a little bit more these days?
I follow the melody, and that's it. I don't care about the chords. I don't chord progressions for shit songwriters.
are you talking about?
If some guy was to walk up to me now with, I'll check these chords out, and I'd say, well, fucking sing something over the top of it, because that's what people are going to remember. Who gives a shit about how fucking cool the chords are? Strawberry Fields without the melody is just a load of fucking weird chords, right? I Am the Walrus without the melody is just a load of fucking weird chords. I accept that weird chord progressions will probably maybe drag something out of you that wasn't there, but I don't go out of my way to be overly cordy. And as I'm saying it now, I will tell you that the Black Keys will probably tell you something different, as having just worked with them, and they were like, fucking hell, where are all these chords coming from? And they're like, fuck. But I put everything into the melody, because that's what's going to last. That's what's going to stand the test of time. I've just been co-writing with them for their next record. It was fucking great. I don't really know them that well. I've met Patrick once or twice, and then they were in London, and then they were coming to London, and their management reached out to my manager, because they know each other, and said, would you be up for maybe dropping by the studio and seeing if you could write something together for their new record? So we did a week in the studio in London and wrote three songs, and I've got to tell you, they're fucking amazing. They're really great.
Yeah, they call you the chord lord, it turns out. Yeah, they disagree with you. Yeah. They disagree with you on the chords.
Indeed. But it's not that if I am in weird chords, it's something that comes instinctively to me, and it's all to support the melody. So I haven't got like a dictaphone with a load of fucking minor chords on that don't make any sense that I'm just waiting to unleash on the world. That's not what I'm about at all.
I had an obscure chord question for you, which is on Don't Look Back in Anger. When you get to the line, Start a Revolution from My Bed, you play an F minor chord. You go to a minor chord in a place where there should be a major chord, which is a Beatles trick, and it's a Beatles reference. Is that a coincidence, or is that an absolutely brilliant little game you're playing with us? So I start a revolution from my bed,
'cause you said the brains I had. Let me see now. Which one are you talking about?
Don't Look Back at
Edgar. That chord.
Yeah.
That one. Yeah. Do you know what? I have no idea what that fucking chord is or why I did that day. Do not ask me. And I've not used it in a single song since. I've never used that thing since. But yeah, it is a classical thing, I believe. I have met songwriters who freaked out about that chord. Honestly, I just glaze over. I'm just like, I have no idea what you're fucking talking about. Because I'm following the melody, you know what I mean? Whatever gets me there is whatever gets me there, and that's it.
What's up, everyone? It's Reality Steve, your number one source for all things Bachelor Nation and reality TV. Every day, I'm giving you the behind-the-scenes juice and your info on all your Bachelor Nation stories, and also interviewing some of your favorite reality stars. My name has been synonymous with spoilers, but I'm so much more than that. Give me a listen.
The Reality Steve Podcast, part of the Bleav Network. Just search BLEAV on YouTube or wherever you listen.
It does remind me of another thing, which is, I don't know if you're aware that Wonderwall has become sort of the new Stairway to Heaven with guitar players, the old Wayne's World thing of the forbidden song, because there's even jokes on TikTok about young guitar players. If a guy picks up an acoustic guitar at a party and puts the capo on the second fret, you know you're in for it.
Well, bless him. Yeah. Yeah, it is literally the simplest fucking song that you can ever fucking wish to play on the guitar. Today is gonna be the day that they're gonna throw it back to you. By now, you should have somehow realized what you got. There's only four fingers, and two of them you don't move at all. George Martin did a documentary in the 90s about music and where these things came from. And somebody asked me to do this documentary. I was like, oh, great, George Martin, it'll be great. And he made me play Wonderwall in front of him and asked me to intellectually articulate what I was thinking. And honestly, it's the most embarrassed I've ever been as a fucking human being, because I was like, this guy. And I had to sit there and go, I just put my fingers there, and then I put them there. And he was going, marvellous. Isn't it just marvellous? And I was thinking, fucking hell, this guy sat in a room with fucking John Lennon when he was writing A Day in the Life. And I'm completely a fucking chancer, do you know what I mean? But yeah, that song is just fucking crazy.
do you remember sitting somewhere and first putting your fingers in those spots and writing this song?
I tell you what happened is I'd never heard of a capo, as you call it. I call it a capo, right? So I'd never heard of a capo. It never dawned on me what one of these things were. And then my guitar tech at the time, he gave me one. And I was like, what the fuck's this? And he said, oh, you just stick it on the neck and you can play open chords anywhere. And honestly, that changed my life. Because then I was like, oh, fuck, fanning around with bar chords, and that's fucking... And I started that song in Scotland somewhere, and then I finished it off in the studio when I got to do Morning Glory. Again, I have no real great recollection of writing it. I don't know why I played that day. I have no idea. But I know, as with all these things, it's like, as soon as I hit it, it sparked off a chain of events that ended up with me having a fucking billion streams of it.
And I guess there was a deal of which song you would get to sing, and that was in contention.
Liam, at the time, I'd got into the habit of walking off stage when things weren't going his way or he couldn't be fucking bothered to do the gig. And I would always have to finish the fucking gig because there would be a riot if he didn't finish it. And of course, I couldn't sing at the time. And I thought, I better start writing a few songs for me to sing in case this kind of thing carries on happening. And I got the sense that both those songs were going to be big. And I remember saying, I'm singing one or the other. He didn't like Wonderwall when he heard it. In fact, he fucking hated it, as did pretty much everything else, until somebody from a record label came down and went, whoa, that's the song that's going to make us all fucking rich and famous. And then he changed his mind and was like, I'll sing that one then. And I sung Don't Look Back in Anger. And yeah, purely for the simple reason that Liam had started to walk off stage regularly and it was becoming fucking annoying. So it was just to kind of, I guess, have one song that was yours. But I'm glad I chose that one, as I think Don't Look Back in Anger is a better song.
You ended up creating the situation that reminds me of The Who, where there were two singers in the band, and then you, once the guitar player starts singing, you do go, wait, you could do the whole show yourself. It's just a dangerous, obviously, which leads us to where we are today.
No, I'm not. It was never like, I'd have left pretty soon. I would have left pretty soon after that, if that's what I thought.
Yeah.
I didn't. Oasis went on for another fucking 15 years or something.
It's true. So.
But I would do acoustic gigs. I didn't really have any designs of being a... I do like singing. Anyone that sings will tell you it's an enjoyable experience to sing. But to be, in inverted commas, a front man is a whole other fucking thing altogether that I still don't really quite understand, and I'm not really into it. But yeah, if it did actually lead to this, then it fucking serves Liam right for being a fucking lazy cunt in the first place.
One thing I realized listening to this album that I'd never put together before, it's a super obvious point, but something about hearing these melodies in your voice, suddenly I said, geez, Coldplay was more influenced by Noel's writing than I ever realized. Yeah. I always thought of them as Radiohead influenced in the beginning, but really they were half Radiohead, half your songwriting. Is that an influence you've ever noticed?
Chris has said that before, but then he says a lot of things. he probably tells fucking Adele that he's influenced by her as well. So I'm not sure how much weight I'd put in that. But I have heard that before, yeah. There was a whole generation who were influenced by Oasis. Some guys were influenced by the attitude of the band and the Liam thing and all that, and they went to start bands, and they got the attitude and all the gear and the swagger and the fucking attitude, and then when they had to come up with the actual thing that makes it work, which is the songs, they didn't have that. And then there was a whole bunch of guys who were into the songs, do you know what I mean? And they became Coldplay and Kasabian and fucking Arctic Monkeys and all that kind of thing. You can't underestimate how influential a band Oasis were, not musically, but in the sense that we kickstarted a kind of a lot of people's, if they can do it, yeah, we can do it. It was a spirit kind of thing, I think.
It's just so, to pick up the fucking guitar. That's what it is.
Just fucking have a go. You know what I mean? Honest to God, my thing was, if I can write songs, I've got the hands of a midget, right? And I'm not the fucking best looking and I can't sing. If I can do it, any fucker can do it. You've just got to have Star Wars levels of self-belief and never fucking, and never say die attitude.
Arctic Monkeys are probably of the slightly younger generation. They're not so young anymore. Probably one of the leading examples of a band falling in your footsteps. But their last two albums, they've mellowed out incredibly. They just can't quite get themselves back to a place where they want to rock. Alex has told me that himself. Like, as much as he might try, it's just not what he wants to do anymore. What do you think of that happening?
I could relate to that. I'd love to write Supersonic and definite and Rock and Roll Star and all that kind of thing. I'd love to, but the key is, and the key with Alex will be, he's already done that.
Mm.
And I've already done that. And if you get to a certain age and you're still trying to fucking write those kind of anthems that you wrote, you've become Kiss. Right? And nobody fucking wants that. So it's like, you can't keep doing that forever. I don't know of a single fucking band in my life whose fan base do not want them to sound like their first two albums. U2 fans are the same. Coldplay fans are the same. Arctic Monkeys fan, Kasabian, everybody. That's what fans want, right? But the songwriters within those bands or the artists, you're on a different path. That's just the way it is.
It does feel like you have mellowed. It happens. It's not a bad thing. It happens to everyone. It's happened to me and my own listening habits to an extent that I could have never imagined. Would you have liked Council Skies if you heard it when you were 28 and got to hear a preview? This is you and God, Jesus, 28 years. Would you have liked it, do you think?
I'd have probably found the track Council Skies a bit challenging, but I would have loved Open the Door. I would have probably loved Love is a Rich Man. But no, a lot of it I wouldn't have been into because I was in a different place. I was into fucking plugging a Les Paul into a Marshall and everybody standing the fuck back and seeing what came out. But yeah, but I don't know. Paul McCartney is the greatest living songwriter in the world. In the world, right? This is the guy that wrote Helter Skelter and I saw her standing there. And you end up where you end up. And I'm sure if he wanted to write Birthday, rewrite Birthday Now and fucking Saw Her Standing There and all those great rockers that he did, he still wouldn't be able to do it because he's not the guy. He's not a rocker anymore.
So do you feel like you're not a rocker anymore?
I'm not sure I ever was a rocker in the first place. I don't know. I don't know. I'm 56. Hang on a minute. I'm 55? 56. I'm 56, right? Let me be 56.
Yeah.
Please. I'm not fucking 27 anymore. I don't want to be 20. I was 27 once and I fucking changed people's lives. You can't carry on doing it. Did it once, twice even, three times even. Let me be 56. Bob Dylan's the fucking same. Bob Dylan, that guy, changed the course of fucking history with those first three albums. You don't do that anymore. He's the same. He'll tell you, even if he wanted to write like a Rolling Stone, he couldn't do it because he's not that guy.
Yeah, yeah. Love is a Rich Man has one of my favorite rock beats. This is a classic beat that people use, and it always works.
I guess there's the Stone Roses and the Sly and the Family Stone thing, and once the drums start, you're in. But it's okay. We're dancing. In that song, the drums came last, so it didn't start with the vibe on the drums or anything. It just started with, it was a lot slower when it started and it gradually got faster and faster until it became what it is.
Johnny Marr came in and played on a bunch of songs, including Pretty Boy. And you said that he doesn't even like to hear the song first. He just comes in and just starts playing.
It's crazy, yeah. He'll arrive and he'll have one amp and a couple of guitars and some pedals, and then he'll make a cup of tea or whatever it is, and we're chatting about football and blah, 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 blah. And then he'll just say, he'll strap on the guitar and he'll say, and then the song starts and he'll go, oh, fucking hell. And while he's listening to the song, he's already figuring out what he's going to do. It's an amazing trip to watch him work. He's just, I don't know, he's just got an innate, he's got a brilliant relationship with his guitar playing. He just knows. I wish, he's the GOAT. He's the fucking greatest of all time. He's the greatest I've ever seen. And yeah, he, when he plays on my stuff, it's very understated and he knows he's not he's not showing off, you know what I mean? He's not a show-off guitarist. He's just, he's backing the song up, and he's an amazing dude. Have you ever met him? Have you ever interviewed
him? Yeah, I interviewed him. Yeah, he's great. He's great.
Yeah.
I asked him why the Smiths broke up, and all these years later, none of those guys can answer that. Weirdest thing on earth. Most bands, at least you really know why they broke up.
I remember asking Johnny, literally one of the first things I ever said to him was like, what happened there then? And the answer that I got was so complicated that I'd actually forgotten what the question was in the first place. And I was like, I'm not even sure what he's fucking talking about now. I can't, I'm not speaking for him, but at least they went out at their peak.
Did you ever see them live?
Oh, fuck yeah. They're my favorite ever bands. They are, to me, they're up there with the Beatles, to me. They've got so many fucking great songs. Changed my life. I was not, you can't hear their influence in my music because Morrissey is one of the most literate people ever to write a song. Johnny is just a fucking wizard. So they never really influenced what I did, but I adore that band. I loved them. They were my life for the 5 years they were together.
That would have been from like when you were 15 to 20, I think.
1983 to 1987, yeah. And the thing is, they split up at the right time, because if they'd have gone on and tried through Acid House, like, they would have just become a parody and people would have turned their back on them. So they split up just at the right time.
I mean, you got to see them live. I never did. A bunch of people never did. Unfortunately, Andy Rourke just died, and now we know they can't get back together. Are people right to be sad about that, or should they just understand that those 5 years were all we're ever going to get?
It depends how old you are. If you're like 17 and you never got to see them, that wasn't your time. If you're my age, 55, and you never 56 and you never got to see them, that's on you. Why didn't you fucking go and see them? They were always on the fucking road. They're fucking always on the road. Yeah, I never got to see Nirvana. I had the chance to go and see them and never did. I'll always regret it. And I never seen the Sex Pistols.
I mean, it's interesting that the extent to which you chronologically coexisted with Nirvana and grunge, it was a different world. Do you feel the 90s slipping into legend? Because I do. Kids talk about it. It's the same distance now or even more than the 60s was from when you grew up. And it's now this like legendary golden age of the way people talk about it.
Yeah, but it's for many. It was pre-internet. We all had freedom of thought and expression. We're all now somehow oppressed by something or other. And it was a very eclectic time. And the ownership of music was king. People bought records and festivals had great fucking lineup. I remember Oasis when we were doing our first ever European festival tour, and the bands we were always on the same bill as Cypress Hill, right? The fucking Wu-Tang Clan, all fucking 67 of them, and the Disposable Heroes of Hypocrisy, and they were fucking great years, and I think everything changed with the internet and YouTube and all that fucking shit. I just think there's no magic left in the world anymore. In the sense that you, if somebody says to you, or would have said to you in 1994, have you heard this band Oasis? You go, no. They say, man, you've got to fucking see them. And you go, right, well, give me a shout next time they're playing. So you'd go. Whereas now, and even if once you were in the gig, we had you because we had these undeniably great songs, and it was loud and it was fucking, it was a bit punk, but it was a bit Beatley, and it was a bit, where are they from, Manchester? Whereas now, if someone says to you, you heard that band Oasis, and you go, no, you take your phone out straight away and you put it in, and there's some shitty video coming out of a fucking speaker, you know, the size of a fucking thumbnail, and you go, nah, I'm not having that. I think the internet changed everything, but I agree. I felt the 90s was great at the time. I genuinely felt it was a fucking golden era at the time.
Your life has been like rock and roll fantasy camp at points. You've played with The Who. You've recorded with Johnny Marr. You've played How Soon Is Now live with Johnny Marr. You've played with Paul Weller and become friends with him. You've jammed in private with Paul McCartney. Is there anything that you on the rock and roll sort of wish list that you haven't done?
There's two things. I would love to meet Roger Waters and just tell him what his songs mean to me. And then I would love to meet Bob Dylan, who recently said that he really liked Oasis. And I'd love to meet him and say, really? Really? Are you being fucking serious? But what I've learned from meeting all those guys and playing with all those guys is, like, they're just ordinary guys with extraordinary gifts. Do you know what I mean? They've got McCartney's just, he's the biggest Beatles fan you'll ever fucking come across in your life. He's just an extraordinarily gifted guy, but he's just a guy. He's just a guy. And Neil Young was just a guy, and I'm in awe of Neil Young, but he's just a fucking guy. He's an odd guy, but he's a fucking just a dude. Johnny Marr's just, he's from the same place I'm from, and they're all just normal. Are they normal? I don't know. They're all ordinary guys with extraordinary gifts. Like, when you're growing up, you think these people are from another planet, or could never be like that, or blah, fucking hell. But I say they're the same as you. They're the same as you and I. They really are.
But you and them, sometimes some kind of magic comes through you. You do something impossible and write songs that, you know, will never die.
Yeah, but that's, I wish it was by design. And I wish I could say I could just turn that shit on and off. But you just have to be, you have to practice it every day and catch it when it falls out of the sky. Like, we were going back to the point we made before about fans wanting to, for you to rewrite Definitely Maybe. I'd love to do that. I'd give one of my children to rewrite that album and it be as good and as vital and as relevant. But it's not going to fucking happen. It's not going to happen. And thank God it happened once.
And the context around you matters tremendously as well. There, in the 90s, going up to the early 2000s, guitar rock was once again at the very center of pop culture. It's been a while since that was the case.
Yeah, I think the record labels are guilty of for most of the sins in the music business now. Why would they want these difficult, dangerous rock and roll bands when they've got Harry Styles? Why would they want that when they've got Ed Sheeran and fucking Sam Smith? And we're living in the era of the fucking solo artist. Do you know what I mean? There are no bands anymore, and bands change the world. Solo artists, it's rare that solo artists change the world. I know Elvis did and Bob Dylan, but that's about it. When you think of it, it's usually the bands that fucking that do it. But the record labels, they've kind of let it slide. And it's all about, the music business is not the music business anymore. It's the fucking selling records business, and there's a difference.
I would defend Harry and Ed, first of all, that they are people playing, actually both of them from time to time, in the rock and roll tradition. They're just not bands per se. And I think you are on an important point there, that it's not just the sounds of rock itself, because you'll hear that in everyone from Olivia Rodrigo to Taylor Swift are actually still do stuff that sounds like rock. But it is the rock band, and that's what you have to wonder.
Okay, hold on. My point is this: is once you're hiring outside songwriters, you don't mean anything. When I was growing up, and then I found out that I'll tell you, I've never loved the Beach Boys, ever. I don't know why. They've got about 6 or 7 great tunes, and then I was watching a documentary once, and I was like, hang on a minute. Who the fuck's this Van Dyke Parks? The fuck's that guy? Oh, he's a lyricist. What? Whoa, 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 whoa. Hang on a minute. So Brian Jones didn't even write the lyrics.
Wilson.
Brian Wilson, sorry. Brian Wilson didn't even write the lyrics. No. And he's like, what the fuck? Why is he revered as a great songwriter? Get to fuck. It's like, I'm not having that. And Harry Styles and Ed Sheeran and all the rest of them, I'm sorry. Once you employ outside people, they're solo artists. How can you be a solo artist if there's someone else writing the fucking songs for you?
Well, ironically, Damon Albarn said the same thing. I know you're cool with him now, but here would be my counter argument. What if they're starting, basically they start up little bands, little co-writing things with each of these people that they work with, and it's just like having tons of bands that you write with.
Be in a fucking band then. Be in a band. That's it. Like, if you're writing songs with a guy, be in a band with that fucking guy. Mm. Oh no, but that guy, he doesn't like going out in public. Well, fuck him off then, the pussy, and fucking find someone else. Oh no, he can't, he's too nervous, he's too shy. Well, fucking kill him then.
Speaking of which, what if your constant attacks on Matty Healy from the 1975, what if they contributed to his breakup with Taylor Swift in some way? I'd imagine you'd feel terrible about that.
What is he going out with Taylor Swift?
He was until like yesterday.
Serves him right then, doesn't it? Taylor has obviously said, now look, keep your fucking nose out of that Gallagher business or we're fucking through. And he couldn't help it. And Swifty, God bless her, said, I can't deal with this shit because once he's done with you, he's going to come after me and I'm not fucking having it. I'm sorry, Matty. You got to go.
Have you thought about how long you want to be out on the road? Guys like Paul, they've now, and Bruce, they've set this example of 70s, 80s. You never get to stop. Mick Jagger, if you're following that example, you're never going to get to stop.
Yeah, I think I'll always write songs. So I will accept that I will always be a songwriter. Therefore, I will be obliged to make records. Therefore, I will be obliged to perform these things until I can't do it anymore. I guess it'll be an instinct where it's just there'll come a point where I won't enjoy it, or that point may never come. I may enjoy it forever. Or in the case of the Rolling Stones, who the fuck wouldn't want to be in the Rolling Stones forever? Come on. Even Charlie Watts, who didn't want to be in the Rolling Stones in the fucking first place, wanted to be in the Rolling Stones forever. So I guess I'll do it as long as I can physically do it.
I understand you're very sick. People are being almost rude and demanding that you reunite your old band, but this does, which I don't want to be, and I know you're sick of talking about it because it keeps coming up. You say that who wouldn't want to be in the Rolling Stones? Some people would say who wouldn't want to be in Oasis? And the answer, obviously, is you, I guess.
I've accepted now that this is never going to go away, and I've put it out there that if Liam really wants to do it, he should fucking call me, and he hasn't called me, so I'm just assuming that he doesn't want it either. I know for a fact he doesn't want it either, but he likes to paint this picture of this little fucking guy who's sitting with his suitcase packed by the door, you know, like the little fucking cat from fucking Shrek, the little fucking Spanish cat with his big fucking teary eyes. I'm going to do it now for you fans. I love you. It's like, well, fucking call me then. And he hasn't called me, so, and until he does, it's fucking going nowhere. But I'll say it for the 1,000,000th fucking time, I am very happy doing what I'm doing at my own pace. I know it's not as commercially successful. I don't give a fuck about that. I wrote Wonderwall. I don't fucking care, okay? And I wrote Don't Look Back in Anger in the same week, right? So I don't care. That commercial shit doesn't fucking bother me anymore. But if the other fellow wants to keep going on about it, then he should fucking call me. And then once he's called me, we'll take it from there.
Yeah, yeah.
After that, there's nothing more to say.
The person in question, when I spoke to him a couple years ago, he's one of the people, and I'm one of them too, who think Be Here Now has taken a bad rap. That it actually has a lot of merits and has some great songs. Where are you currently with that album?
Stand By Me has been in a big advert in the UK for about 3 years now. Times are hard when things have got no meaning. Found a key upon the floor. And once you hear it about 1,000,000 fucking times a week, I've gotten back into that song. But I don't... The songs are... If I could have my time again, I would definitely have made those songs a little bit shorter. And I was out of control as a guy anyway. I wouldn't listen to anyone at the time. I wouldn't listen to anyone about anything because I was the biggest songwriter in the world and fucking who the fuck are these people to tell me how to write songs? You know what I mean? So I wouldn't, if I had my time again though, I'd probably give it a bit more of a considered thought. But I do like Do You Know What I Mean? And I've always liked My Big Mouth. And yeah, it's just a bit, yeah, I think a lot of the lyrics are fucking dreadful.
The cliche narrative is that a lot of that was cocaine.
It was, yeah. A lot of cocaine and KFC, as I remember correctly. It just leads to a lot of drinking and eating junk food. So, yeah, from 1997 all the way through 1997, I was a bit overweight, but fuck me, I had a great time. That's the main thing.
You look good. Do you have a fitness routine or is it just genetics?
I'm in between houses at the minute because I'm living out of hotels back in London and I've not had a great couple of years. But yeah, ordinarily, I'd have a gym in my house and I'd go there every day and symbolically do something. But I don't really, I think it's genetics. I've got to say, I've got to thank my mum for that.
Once you're off the road, you got to buy a house and find your new life. Is that, yeah. Are you looking forward to that? You might be dating and stuff. Are you ready for all that?
I'm not sure about dating. I'm not sure about that. I mean, the women that I meet are absolutely fucking insane. But I've got to buy, I'm getting a new house. And then when this tour is done, which will be sometime in 24, I'll be back in London and get into the routine of a new life, which I'm looking forward to. But it's been a turbulent few years, to say the least. But I'm old enough now to know that all things must pass and eventually things will calm down and I'll be back cruising again.
And have you started to map out like the next decade and what you want to do?
I wouldn't say decade, but I would definitely like to make, I'm definitely going to, because in the lockdown, I wrote about best part of 40 songs.
Wow.
So this album was a cross section of all the different styles that I'd done to that point, which is what I liked about the album. Pretty Boy was a bit like the electronic thing. And then there was the ballady thing. And then there was the 60s thing. And then there was like a bit of a jazz thing with Council Skies. So I picked the best things that brought me to this place so far. But there is an acoustic album as well, which is very stripped back. Mm. And which I started recording actually recently before I came away. And then there's a very heavily guitar-based stadium rock album.
Why would you not put that one out first?
I don't know. I don't know. I just felt that this was, I mean, I've been proved right anyway in this decision because the album's been received amazingly well and better than any album I've ever had so far.
Yeah.
So I've been proved right in that respect. But why didn't I go with that? I don't know. I guess because I didn't really know if stadium rock was going to be allowed anymore because of COVID and all that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was like, I didn't know if there was going to be a tour or any of that shit. It was just like, things have changed drastically, but the guitar album I'm looking forward to recording, but I think it's time I did an acoustic album because I've got a lot of songs that are quite harrowing because they're obviously written in the time of breakup. So I want to get that out. I want to get that out of the way now and then do a euphoric guitar record.
So when you say acoustic, how stripped down are we talking about?
No, it'll be dead in the water kind of thing, which I'm not sure. I'm going to have to think long and hard about it because what my fans and even I will go, oh, fucking on an acoustic album. But really, four songs like that in a row, come on, they get fucking boring. They get boring for me to listen to. So I'm going to have to think of something. It'll be an acoustic album with a twist. It definitely will be acoustic. I don't think there'll be any electronic instruments on it. That'll be the rule.
Well, no, I won't keep you. You have a show to play. A lot of fun. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you very much.
And that's our show. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, subscribe to Rolling Stone Music Now wherever you get your podcasts. And please leave us 5 stars and a nice review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify because that's always appreciated. But as always, thanks for listening. And we will see you next week.
Welcome to Talkville,
the ultimate Smallville rewatch podcast. Guest star Sarah Carter as Alicia Baker.
Although I didn't really work with her a lot.
But Tom did, and they had some real big smoochy scenes.
Yeah. Should we talk about that?
Could there be any more sex? What was a 3-page makeout scene that just kept going? Good Lord. We get it. They have chemistry.
Jump in now or catch up on any of the past seasons of Talkville on YouTube or wherever you listen.